Chapter 13, Continued. Now panicking slightly about the amount of homework they had to do, Harry and Ron spent their lunch hour in the library, looking up the uses of moonstones in potion-making. Still angry about Ron's slur on her woolly hat, Hermione did not join them. By the time they reached care of magical creatures in the afternoon, Harry's head was aching again. The day had become cool and breezy, and as they walked down the sloping lawn towards Hagrid's cabin on the edge of the Forbidden Forest, they felt the occasional drop of rain on their faces. Professor Grubbly Plank stood waiting for the class some 10 yards from Hagrid's front door, a long trestle table in front of her, laden with twigs. As Harry and Ron reached her, a loud shout of laughter sounded behind them. Turning, they saw Draco Malfoy striding towards them, surrounded by his usual gang of Slytherin cronies. He had clearly just said something highly amusing, because Crabbe, Goyle, Pansy Parkinson and the rest continued to snigger heartily as they gathered around the trestle table, and, judging by the way they all kept looking over at Harry, he was able to guess the subject of the joke without too much difficulty.
"Everyone here?"
barked Professor Grubbly Plank, once all the Slytherins and Gryffindors had arrived.
"Let's crack on, then. Who can tell me what these things are called?"
She indicated the heap of twigs in front of her. Hermione's hand shot into the air. Behind her back, Malfoy did a buck-toothed imitation of her, jumping up and down in eagerness to answer a question. Pansy Parkinson gave a shriek of laughter that turned almost at once into a scream as the twigs on the table leapt into the air and revealed themselves to be what looked like tiny pixie-ish creatures made of wood, each with knobbly brown arms and legs, two twig-like fingers at the end of each hand, and a funny, flat, bark-like face in which a pair of beetle-brown eyes glittered.
"Oh!"
said Parvati and Lavender, thoroughly irritating Harry. Anyone would have thought Hagrid had never shown them impressive creatures. Admittedly, the flobberworms had been a bit dull, but the salamanders and hippogriffs had been interesting enough, and the blast-ended scroots, perhaps too much so.
"Kindly keep your voices down, girls,"
said Professor Grubbly Plank sharply, scattering a handful of what looked like brown rice among the stick creatures, who immediately fell upon the food.
"So, anyone know the names of these creatures? Miss Granger?"
"Bow truckles," said Hermione. "They're tree guardians. Usually live in wand trees."
5 points for Gryffindor," said Professor Grubbly Plank. "Yes, these are bow truckles, and as Miss Granger rightly says, they generally live in trees whose wood is of wand quality. Anybody know what they eat?"
"Woodlice," said Hermione promptly, which explained why what Harry had taken to be grains of brown rice were moving. "But fairy eggs, if they can get them."
"Good girl. Take another 5 points. So, whenever you need leaves or wood from a tree in which a bow truckle lodges, it is wise to have a gift of woodlice ready to distract or placate it. They may not look dangerous, but if angered, they will try to gouge at human eyes with their fingers, which, as you can see, are very sharp and not at all desirable near the eyeballs. So, if you'd like to gather closer, take a few woodlice and a bow truckle. I have enough here for one between three. You can study them more closely. I want a sketch from each of you, with all body parts labelled, by the end of the lesson."
The class surged forwards around the trestle table. Harry deliberately circled around the back so that he ended up right next to Professor Grubbly Plank. "Where's Hagrid?" he asked her, while everyone else was choosing bow truckles.
"Never you mind,"
said Professor Grubbly Plank repressively, which had been her attitude last time Hagrid had failed to turn up for a class too. Smirking all over his pointed face, Draco Malfoy leaned across Harry and seized the largest bow truckle.
"Maybe," said Malfoy in an undertone, so that only Harry could hear him, "the stupid great oaf's got himself badly injured."
"Maybe you will, if you don't shut up," said Harry out of the side of his mouth.
"Maybe he's been messing with stuff that's too big for him, if you get my drift."
Malfoy walked away, smirking over his shoulder at Harry, who felt suddenly sick. Did Malfoy know something? His father was a Death Eater, after all. What if he had information about Hagrid's fate that had not yet reached the ears of the Order? He hurried back around the table to Ron and Hermione, who were squatting on the grass some distance away and attempting to persuade a bow truckle to remain still long enough for them to draw it. Harry pulled out parchment and quill, crouched down beside the others, and related in a whisper what Malfoy had just said.
"Dumbledore would know if something had happened to Hagrid," said Hermione at once. "It's just playing into Malfoy's hands to look worried. It tells him we don't know exactly what's going on. We've got to ignore him, Harry. Here, hold the bow truckle for a moment, just so I can draw its face."
"Yes," came Malfoy's clear drawl from the group nearest them. "Father was talking to the minister just a couple of days ago, you know, and it sounds as though the minister is really determined to crack down on substandard teaching in this place. So even if that overgrown moron does show up again, he'll probably be sent packing straight away."
Ouch!
Harry had gripped the bow truckle so hard that it had almost snapped, and it had just taken a great retaliatory swipe at his hand with its sharp fingers, leaving two long, deep cuts there. Harry dropped it. Crabbe and Goyle, who had already been guffawing at the idea of Hagrid being sacked, laughed still harder as the bow truckle set off at full tilt towards the forest, a little moving stick man soon swallowed up among the tree roots. When the bell echoed distantly over the grounds, Harry rolled up his blood-stained bow-truckle picture and marched off to Herbology with his hand wrapped in Hermione's handkerchief and Malfoy's derisive laughter still ringing in his ears. "If he calls Hagrid a moron one more time," snarled Harry.
"Harry, don't go picking a row with Malfoy. Don't forget he's a prefect now. He could make life difficult for you."
"Wow, I wonder what it'd be like to have a difficult life," said Harry sarcastically.
Ron laughed, but Hermione frowned. Together they traipsed across the vegetable patch. The sky still appeared unable to make up its mind whether it wanted to rain or not.
"I just wish Hagrid would hurry up and get back, that's all," said Harry in a low voice as they reached the greenhouses.
"And don't say that grubbly plank woman's a better teacher," he added threateningly.
"I wasn't going to," said Hermione calmly.
"Because she'll never be as good as Hagrid," said Harry firmly,
fully aware that he had just experienced an exemplary care of magical creatures lesson and was thoroughly annoyed about it. The door of the nearest greenhouse opened and some fourth years spilled out of it, including Ginny.
"Hi,"
she said brightly as she passed. A few seconds later, Luna Lovegood emerged, trailing behind the rest of the class, a smudge of earth on her nose, and her hair tied in a knot on the top of her head. When she saw Harry, her prominent eyes seemed to bulge excitedly, and she made a beeline straight for him. Many of his classmates turned curiously to watch. Luna took a great breath, and then said, without so much as a preliminary hello, "I believe he who must not be named is back, and I believe you fought him and escaped from him."
"Right," said Harry awkwardly.
Luna was wearing what looked like a pair of orange radishes for earrings, a fact that Parvati and Lavender seemed to have noticed as they were both giggling and pointing at her earlobes.
"You can laugh,"
Luna said, her voice rising, apparently under the impression that Parvati and Lavender were laughing at what she had said, rather than what she was wearing. "But people used to believe there were no such things as the blibbering humdinger or the crumple-horned snorkack."
"Well, they were right, weren't they?" said Hermione impatiently. "There weren't any such things as the blibbering humdinger or the crumple-horned snorkack."
Luna gave her a withering look and flounced away, radishes swinging madly. Parvati and Lavender were not the only ones hooting with laughter now.
"Do you mind not offending the only people who believe me?" Harry asked Hermione as they made their way into class.
"Oh, for heaven's sake, Harry, you can do better than her," said Hermione. "Ginny's told me all about her. Apparently she'll only believe in things as long as there's no proof at all. Well, I wouldn't expect anything else from someone whose father runs the Quibbler."
Harry thought of the sinister winged horses he had seen on the night he had arrived and how Luna had said she could see them too. His spirits sank slightly.
Had she been lying? But before he could devote much more thought to the matter, Ernie Macmillan had stepped up to him. "I want you to know, Potter," he said in a loud, carrying voice, "that it's not only weirdos who support you. I personally believe you 100%. My family have always stood firm behind Dumbledore, and so do I."
"Thanks very much, Ernie," said Harry, taken aback but pleased. Ernie might be pompous on occasions like this, but Harry was in a mood to deeply appreciate a vote of confidence from somebody who did not have radishes dangling from their ears. Ernie's words had certainly wiped the smile from Lavender Brown's face, and as he turned to talk to Ron and Hermione, Harry caught Seamus's expression, which looked both confused and defiant. To nobody's surprise, Professor Sprout started their lesson by lecturing them about the importance of OWLs. Harry wished all the teachers would stop doing this. He was starting to get an anxious, twisted feeling in his stomach every time he remembered how much homework he had to do, a feeling that worsened dramatically when Professor Sprout gave them yet another essay at the end of class. Tired and smelling strongly of dragon dung, Professor Sprout's preferred type of fertilizer, the Gryffindors trooped back up to the castle an hour and a half later, none of them talking very much. It had been another long day. As Harry was starving, and he had his first detention with Umbridge at 5 o'clock, he headed straight for dinner without dropping off his bag in Gryffindor Tower so that he could bolt something down before facing whatever she had in store for him. He had barely reached the entrance of the Great Hall, however, when a loud and angry voice yelled, "Oi! Potter!" "What now?" he muttered wearily, turning to face Angelina Johnson, who looked as though she was in a towering temper. "I'll tell you what now," she said, marching straight up to him and poking him hard in the chest with her finger. "How come you've landed yourself in detention for 5 o'clock on Friday?"
"What?" said Harry.
"Why, oh, yeah, keeper tryouts."
"Now he remembers," snarled Angelina. "Didn't I tell you I wanted to do a tryout with the whole team and find someone who fitted in with everyone? Didn't I tell you I'd booked the Quidditch pitch specially? And now you've decided you're not going to be there?"
"I didn't decide not to be there," said Harry, stung by the injustice of these words. "I got detention from that Umbridge woman just because I told her the truth about you-know-who."
"Well, you can just go straight to her and ask her to let you off on Friday," said Angelina fiercely, "and I don't care how you do it. Tell her you-know-who's a figment of your imagination, if you like. Just make sure you're there." She stormed away.
"You know what?" Harry said to Ron and Hermione as they entered the Great Hall. "I think we'd better check with Puddlemere United whether Oliver Wood's been killed during a training session, because Angelina seems to be channeling his spirit."
"What do you reckon are the odds of Umbridge letting you off on Friday?" said Ron sceptically, as they sat down at the Gryffindor table.
"Less than zero," said Harry glumly, tipping lamb chops onto his plate and starting to eat. "Better try, though, hadn't I? I'll offer to do 2 more detentions or something, I don't know." He swallowed a mouthful of potato and added, "I hope she doesn't keep me too long this evening. You realise we've got to write 3 essays, practice vanishing spells for McGonagall, work out a countercharm for Flitwick, finish the Bowtruckle drawing and start that stupid dream diary for Trelawney." Ron moaned and for some reason glanced up at the ceiling.
"And it looks like it's going to rain."
"What's that got to do with our homework?" said Hermione, her eyebrows raised.
"Nothing," said Ron at once, his ears reddening.
At 5 to 5, Harry bade the other two goodbye and set off for Umbridge's office on the 3rd floor. When he knocked on the door, she called, "Come in," in a sugary voice. He entered cautiously, looking around. He had known this office under 3 of its previous occupants. In the days when Gilderoy Lockhart had lived here, it had been plastered in beaming portraits of himself. When Lupin had occupied it, it was likely you would meet some fascinating dark creature in a cage or tank if you came to call.
In the imposter Moody's days, it had been packed with various instruments and artifacts for the detection of wrongdoing and concealment. Now, however, it looked totally unrecognizable. The surfaces had all been draped in lacy covers and cloths. There were several vases full of dried flowers, each one residing in its own doily. And on one of the walls was a collection of ornamental plates, each decorated with a large technicolour kitten wearing a different bow around its neck. These were so foul that Harry stared at them, transfixed, until Professor Umbridge spoke again. "Good evening, Mr. Potter." Harry started and looked around. He had not noticed her at first because she was wearing a luridly flowered set of robes that blended only too well with the tablecloth on the desk behind her. "Evening, Professor Umbridge," Harry said stiffly. "Well, sit down," she said, pointing towards a small table draped in lace, beside which she had drawn up a straight-backed chair. A piece of blank parchment lay on the table, apparently waiting for him. Said Harry, without moving. "Professor Umbridge, before we start, I wanted to ask you a favour." Her bulging eyes narrowed.
"Oh, yes?"
"Well, I'm in the Gryffindor Quidditch team, and I was supposed to be at the tryouts for the new keeper at 5 o'clock on Friday, and I was wondering whether I could skip detention that night and do it another night instead." He knew long before he reached the end of his sentence that it was no good.
"Oh, no," said Umbridge, smiling so widely that she looked as though she had just swallowed a particularly juicy fly. "Oh, no, no, no. This is your punishment for spreading evil, nasty, attention-seeking stories, Mr. Potter, and punishment certainly cannot be adjusted to suit the guilty one's convenience. No. You will come here at 5 o'clock tomorrow, and the next day, and on Friday, too, and you will do your detentions as planned. I think it rather a good thing that you're missing something you really want to do. It ought to reinforce the lesson I am trying to teach you."
Harry felt the blood surge to his head and heard a thumping noise in his ears. So he told evil, nasty, attention-seeking stories, did he? She was watching him with her head slightly to one side, still smiling widely, as though she knew exactly what he was thinking, and was waiting to see whether he would start shouting again. With a massive effort, Harry looked away from her, dropped his school bag beside the straight-backed chair, and sat down.
"There," said Umbridge sweetly. "We're getting better at controlling our temper already, aren't we? Now, you're going to be doing some lines for me, Mr. Potter." "No, not with your quill," she added, as Harry bent down to open his bag. "You're going to be using a rather special one of mine. Here you are."
She handed him a long, thin, black quill with an unusually sharp point.
"I want you to write, 'I must not tell lies,'" she told him softly.
"How many times?" Harry asked, with a creditable imitation of politeness.
"Oh, as long as it takes for the message to sink in," said Umbridge sweetly. "Off you go."
She moved over to her desk, sat down, and bent over a stack of parchment that looked like essays for marking. Harry raised the sharp black quill, then realized what was missing.
"You haven't given me any ink," he said. "Oh, you won't need ink," said Professor Umbridge, with the merest suggestion of a laugh in her voice.
Harry placed the point of the quill on the paper and wrote, "I must not tell lies." He let out a gasp of pain. The words had appeared on the parchment in what appeared to be shining red ink. At the same time, the words had appeared on the back of Harry's right hand, cut into his skin as though traced there by a scalpel. Yet even as he stared at the shining cut, the skin healed over again, leaving the place where it had been slightly redder than before, but quite smooth. Harry looked round at Umbridge. She was watching him, her wide, toad-like mouth stretched in a smile.
"Yes?"
"Nothing," said Harry quietly. He looked back at the parchment, placed the quill on it once more, wrote, "I must not tell lies," and felt the searing pain on the back of his hand for a second time. Once again the words had been cut into his skin. Once again they healed over seconds later. And on it went. Again and again Harry wrote the words on the parchment in what he soon came to realize was not ink, but his own blood. And again the words were cut into the back of his hand, healed, and reappeared the next time he set quill to parchment. Darkness fell outside Umbridge's window. Harry did not ask when he would be allowed to stop. He did not even check his watch. He knew she was watching him for signs of weakness, and he was not going to show any, not even if he had to sit there all night, cutting open his own hand with this quill.
"Come here,"
she said, after what seemed hours. He stood up. His hand was stinging painfully. When he looked down at it, he saw that the cut had healed, but that the skin there was red raw.
"Hand," she said.
He extended it. She took it in her own. Harry repressed a shudder as she touched him with her thick, stubby fingers, on which she wore a number of ugly old rings.
"I don't seem to have made much of an impression yet," she said, smiling. "Well, we'll just have to try again tomorrow evening, won't we? You may go."
Harry left her office without a word. The school was quite deserted. It was surely past midnight. He walked slowly up the corridor, then, when he had turned the corner and was sure she would not hear him, broke into a run. He had not time to practice vanishing spells, had not written a single dream in his dream diary, and had not finished the drawing of the bow truckle, nor had he written his essays. He skipped breakfast next morning to scribble down a couple of made-up dreams for divination, their first lesson, and was surprised to find a dishevelled Ron keeping him company.
"How come you didn't do it last night?"
Harry asked, as Ron stared wildly around the common room for inspiration. Ron, who had been fast asleep when Harry got back to the dormitory, muttered something about doing other stuff, bent low over his parchment, and scrawled a few words.
"That'll have to do," he said, slamming the diary shut. "I've said I dreamed I was buying a new pair of shoes. She can't make anything weird out of that, can she?"
They hurried off to North Tower together.
"How was detention with Umbridge, anyway? What did she make you do?"
Harry hesitated for a fraction of a second, then said, "Lines."
"Oh, that's not too bad then, eh?" said Ron.
"Nope," said Harry.
"Hey, I forgot. Did she let you off for Friday?"
"No," said Harry. Ron groaned sympathetically. It was another bad day for Harry. He was one of the worst in Transfiguration, not having practiced vanishing spells at all. He had to give up his lunch hour to complete the picture of the bow truckle, and meanwhile Professors McGonagall, Grubbly Plank, and Sinistra gave them yet more homework, which he had no prospect of finishing that evening because of his second detention with Umbridge. To cap it all, Angelina Johnson tracked him down at dinner again, and, on learning that he would not be able to attend Friday's keeper tryouts, told him she was not at all impressed by his attitude, and that she expected players who wished to remain on the team to put training before their other commitments.
"I'm in detention!" Harry yelled after her as she stalked away. "Do you think I'd rather be stuck in a room with that old toad or playing Quidditch?"
"At least it's only lines," said Hermione consolingly, as Harry sank back onto his bench and looked down at his steak and kidney pie, which he no longer fancied very much. "It's not as if it's a dreadful punishment, really." Harry opened his mouth, closed it again, and nodded. He was not really sure why he was not telling Ron and Hermione exactly what was happening in Umbridge's room. He only knew that he did not want to see their looks of horror. That would make the whole thing seem worse, and therefore more difficult to face. He also felt dimly that this was between himself and Umbridge, a private battle of wills. and he was not going to give her the satisfaction of hearing that he had complained about it.
"I can't believe how much homework we've got," said Ron miserably.
"Well, why didn't you do any last night?" Hermione asked him. "Where were you, anyway?"
I fancied a walk," said Ron shiftily.
Harry had the distinct impression that he was not alone in concealing things at the moment.
The second detention was just as bad as the previous one. The skin on the back of Harry's hand became irritated more quickly now, and was soon red and inflamed. Harry thought it unlikely that it would keep healing as effectively for long. Soon the cut would remain etched into his hand, and Umbridge would, perhaps, be satisfied. He let no gasp of pain escape him, however, and from the moment of entering the room to the moment of his dismissal, again past midnight, he said nothing but "good evening" and "good night." His homework situation, however, was now desperate. And when he returned to the Gryffindor common room, he did not, though exhausted, go to bed, but opened his books and began Snape's Moonstone essay. It was 2:30 by the time he had finished it. He knew he had done a poor job, but there was no help for it. Unless he had something to give in, he would be in detention with Snape next. He then dashed off answers to the questions Professor McGonagall had set them, cobbled together something on the proper handling of bow truckles for Professor Grubbly Plank, and staggered up to bed, where he fell fully clothed on top of the covers, and fell asleep immediately. Thursday passed in a haze of tiredness. Ron seemed very sleepy too, though Harry could not see why he should be. Harry's third detention passed in the same way as the previous two, except that after 2 hours the words, "I must not tell lies," did not fade from the back of Harry's hand, but remained, scratched there, oozing droplets of blood. The pause in the pointed quill scratching made Professor Umbridge look up. "Ah," she said softly, moving around her desk to examine his hand herself. "Good. That ought to serve as a reminder to you, oughtn't it? You may leave for tonight."
"Do I still have to come back tomorrow?" said Harry, picking up his school bag with his left hand rather than his smarting right one.
"Oh, yes," said Professor Umbridge, smiling as widely as before. "Yes, I think we can etch the message a little deeper with another evening's work."
Harry had never before considered the possibility that there might be another teacher in the world he hated more than Snape. But as he walked back towards Gryffindor Tower, he had to admit he had found a strong contender. "She's evil," he thought, as he climbed a staircase to the 7th floor. "She's an evil, twisted, mad old—" "Ron?" He had reached the top of the stairs, turned right, and almost walked into Ron, who was lurking behind a statue of Lochlin the Lanky, clutching his broomstick. He gave a great leap of surprise when he saw Harry and attempted to hide his new Clean Sweep 11 behind his back.
"What are you doing?"
Nothing. What are you doing?"
Harry frowned at him.
"Come on, you can tell me. What are you hiding here for?"
I'm hiding from Fred and George, if you must know," said Ron. "They just went past with a bunch of first years. I bet they're testing stuff on them again. I mean, they can't do it in the common room now, can they? Not with Hermione there."
He was talking in a very fast, feverish way.
"But what have you got your broom for? You haven't been flying, have you?" Harry asked.
Well, okay, I'll tell you. But don't laugh, all right?" Ron said defensively, turning redder with every second. I thought I'd try out for Gryffindor Keeper. Now I've got a decent broom. There. Go on, laugh."
"I'm not laughing," said Harry.
Ron blinked.
"It's a brilliant idea. It'd be really cool if you got on the team. I've never seen you play keeper. Are you good?"
"I'm not bad," said Ron, who looked immensely relieved at Harry's reaction. "Charlie, Fred and George always made me keep for them when they were training during the holidays."
"So you've been practising tonight?"
"Every evening since Tuesday. Just on my own, though. I've been trying to bewitch Quaffles to fly at me, but it hasn't been easy, and I don't know how much use it'll be."
Ron looked nervous and anxious.
Fred and George are going to laugh themselves stupid when I turn up for the tryouts. They haven't stopped taking the mickey out of me since I got made a prefect. I wish I was going to be there, said Harry bitterly, as they set off together towards the common room. Yeah, so... Harry, what's that on the back of your hand? Harry, who had just scratched his nose with his free right hand, tried to hide it, but had as much success as Ron with his clean sweep. It's just a cut. It's nothing. It's... But Ron had grabbed Harry's forearm and pulled the back of Harry's hand up level with his eyes. There was a pause, during which he stared at the words carved into the skin. Then, looking sick, he released Harry. I thought you said she was just giving you lines. Harry hesitated. But after all, Ron had been honest with him. So he told Ron the truth about the hours he had been spending in Umbridge's office. "The old hag!" Ron said in a revolted whisper as they came to a halt in front of the fat lady, who was dozing peacefully with her head against her frame. "She's sick! Go to McGonagall! Say something!" "No," said Harry at once. "I'm not giving her the satisfaction of knowing she's got to me." "Got to you? You can't let her get away with this!" "I don't know how much power McGonagall's got over her," said Harry. "Dumbledore, then! Tell Dumbledore!" "No," said Harry flatly. "Why not?" "He's got enough on his mind," said Harry. But that was not the true reason. He was not going to go to Dumbledore for help when Dumbledore had not spoken to him once since June. "Well, I reckon you should..." Ron began. But he was interrupted by the fat lady, who had been watching them sleepily, and now burst out, "Are you going to give me the password? Or will I have to stay awake all night, waiting for you to finish your conversation?" Friday dawned sullen and sodden as the rest of the week. Though Harry automatically glanced towards the staff table when he entered the great hall, it was without any real hope of seeing Hagrid, and he turned his mind immediately to his more pressing problems, such as the mountainous pile of homework he had to do, and the prospect of yet another detention with Umbridge. Two things sustained Harry that day. One was the thought that it was almost the weekend. The other was that, dreadful though his final detention with Umbridge was sure to be, he had a distant view of the Quidditch pitch from her window, and might, with luck, be able to see something of Ron's tryout. These were rather feeble rays of light, it was true, but Harry was grateful for anything that might lighten his present darkness. He had never had a worse first week of term at Hogwarts. At 5 o'clock that evening, he knocked on Professor Umbridge's office door for what he sincerely hoped would be the final time, and was told to enter. The blank parchment lay ready for him on the lace-covered table, the pointed black quill beside it. "You know what to do, Mr. Potter," said Umbridge, smiling sweetly at him. Harry picked up the quill and glanced through the window. If he just shifted his chair an inch or so to the right, on the pretext of shifting himself closer to the table, he managed it. He now had a distant view of the Gryffindor Quidditch team soaring up and down the pitch, while half a dozen black figures stood at the foot of the three high goalposts, apparently awaiting their turn to keep. It was impossible to tell which one was Ron at this distance. "I must not tell lies," Harry wrote. The cut in the back of his right hand opened and began to bleed afresh. "I must not tell lies." The cut dug deeper, stinging and smarting. "I must not tell lies." Blood trickled down his wrist. He chanced another glance out of the window. Whoever was defending the goalposts now was doing a very poor job indeed. Katie Bell scored twice in the few seconds Harry dared to watch. Hoping very much that the keeper wasn't Ron, he dropped his eyes back to the parchment shining with blood. "I must not tell lies. I must not tell lies." He looked up whenever he thought he could risk it, when he could hear the scratching of Umbridge's quill or the opening of a desk drawer. The third person to try out was pretty good. The fourth was terrible. The fifth dodged a bludger exceptionally well, but then fumbled an easy save. The sky was darkening, and Harry doubted he would be able to see the sixth and seventh people at all. I must not tell lies. I must not tell lies. The parchment was now dotted with drops of blood from the back of his hand, which was searing with pain. When he next looked up, night had fallen, and the Quidditch pitch was no longer visible.
"Let's see if you've got the message yet, shall we?" said Umbridge's soft voice half an hour later.
She moved towards him, stretching out her short, ringed fingers for his arm. And then, as she took hold of him to examine the words now cut into his skin, pain seared, not across the back of his hand, but across the scar on his forehead. At the same time, he had a most peculiar sensation somewhere around his midriff. He wrenched his arm out of her grip and leapt to his feet, staring at her. She looked back at him, a smile stretching her wide, slack mouth.
"Yes, it hurts, doesn't it?" she said softly.
He did not answer. His heart was thumping very hard and fast. Was she talking about his hand, or did she know what he had just felt in his forehead?
"Well, I think I've made my point, Mr. Potter. You may go."
He caught up his school bag and left the room as quickly as he could. "Stay calm," he told himself as he sprinted up the stairs. "Stay calm. It doesn't necessarily mean what you think it means. Mimbulus Mimbletonia," he gasped at the fat lady, who swung forwards once more. A roar of sound greeted him. Ron came running towards him, beaming all over his face and slopping butterbeer down his front from the goblet he was clutching.
"Harry, I did it! I'm in! I'm keeper!"
"What?"
"Oh, brilliant,"
said Harry, trying to smile naturally, while his heart continued to race and his hand throbbed and bled.
"Have a butterbeer."
Ron pressed a bottle on him.
"I can't believe it. Where's Hermione gone?"
"She's there," said Fred, who was also swigging butterbeer, and pointed to an armchair by the fire. Hermione was dozing in it, her drink tipping precariously in her hand.
"Well, she said she was pleased when I told her," said Ron, looking slightly put out. "Let her sleep," said George hastily.
It was a few moments before Harry noticed that several of the first years gathered around them bore unmistakable signs of recent nosebleeds.
"Come here, Ron, and see if Oliver's old robes fit you," called Katie Bell. "We can take off his name and put yours on instead."
As Ron moved away, Angelina came striding up to Harry.
"Sorry I was a bit short with you earlier, Potter," she said abruptly. "It's stressful, this managing lark, you know. I'm starting to think I was a bit hard on wood sometimes."
She was watching Ron over the rim of her goblet with a slight frown on her face.
"Look, I know he's your best mate, but he's not fabulous," she said bluntly. "I think with a bit of training he'll be all right, though. He comes from a family of good Quidditch players. I'm banking on him turning out to have a bit more talent than he showed today, to be honest. Vicky Frobisher and Geoffrey Hooper both flew better this evening, but Hooper's a real whiner. He's always moaning about something or other, and Vicky's involved in all sorts of societies. She admitted herself that if training clashed with her charms club, she'd put charms first. Anyway, we're having a practice session at 2 o'clock tomorrow, so just make sure you're there this time. And do me a favour and help Ron as much as you can, okay?"
He nodded, and Angelina strolled back to Alicia Spinett. Harry moved over to sit next to Hermione, who awoke with a jerk as he put down his bag.
"Oh, Harry, it's you.
Good about Ron, isn't it?"
she said blearily.
"I'm just so tired, she yawned. "I was up until 1 o'clock making more hats. They're disappearing like mad."
And sure enough, now that he looked, Harry saw that there were woolly hats concealed all around the room where unwary elves might accidentally pick them up. "Great," said Harry, distractedly. If he did not tell somebody soon, he would burst.
"Listen, Hermione, I was just up in Umbridge's office, and she touched my arm."
Hermione listened closely. When Harry had finished, she said slowly,
"'You're worried you-know-who's controlling her, like he controlled Quirrell?'
"'Well,' said Harry, dropping his voice, "'it's a possibility, isn't it?'
"'I suppose so,' said Hermione, though she sounded unconvinced. "'But I don't think he can be possessing her the way he possessed Quirrell. "'I mean, he's properly alive again now, isn't he? "'He's got his own body. "'He wouldn't need to share someone else's. "'He could have her under the Imperius curse, I suppose.'
Harry watched Fred, George, and Lee Jordan juggling empty butterbeer bottles for a moment. Then Hermione said, "'But last year your scar hurt when nobody was touching you, and didn't Dumbledore say it had to do with what you-know-who was feeling at the time? I mean, maybe this hasn't got anything to do with Umbridge at all. Maybe it's just coincidence it happened while you were with her.'
"'She's evil,' said Harry flatly. "'Twisted.' "'She's horrible, yes, but, Harry, I think you ought to tell Dumbledore your scar hurt.'
It was the second time in 2 days he had been advised to go to Dumbledore, and his answer to Hermione was just the same as his answer to Ron. "'I'm not bothering him with this. Like you just said, it's not a big deal. It's been hurting on and off all summer. It was just a bit worse tonight, that's all.
Harry, I'm sure Dumbledore would want to be bothered by this.'
"'Yeah,' said Harry, before he could stop himself. "'That's the only bit of me Dumbledore cares about, isn't it? My scar.'
"'Don't say that. It's not true.'
"'I think I'll write and tell Sirius about it, see what he thinks.'
"'Harry, you can't put something like that in a letter,' said Hermione, looking alarmed. "'Don't you remember Moody told us to be careful what we put in writing? "'We just can't guarantee owls aren't being intercepted any more.'
all right, I won't tell him then.' said Harry irritably. He got to his feet. "'I'm going to bed. Tell Ron for me, will you?'
"'Oh, no,' said Hermione, looking relieved. "'If you're going, that means I can go too, without being rude. I'm absolutely exhausted, and I want to make some more hats tomorrow. Listen, you can help me if you like. It's quite fun. I'm getting better. I can do patterns and bobbles and all sorts of things now.'
Harry looked into her face, which was shining with glee, and tried to look as though he was vaguely tempted by this offer.
No, I don't think I will, thanks, he said. Not tomorrow. I've got loads of homework to do.
And he traipsed off to the boys' stairs, leaving her looking slightly disappointed.
Chapter 14 Percy and Padfoot Harry was first to wake up in his dormitory next morning. He lay for a moment, watching dust swirl in the ray of sunlight coming through the gap in his four-poster's hangings, and savoured the thought that it was Saturday. The first week of term seemed to have dragged on for ever, like one gigantic history of magic lesson. Judging by the sleepy silence and the freshly minted look of that beam of sunlight, it was just after daybreak. He pulled open the curtains around his bed, got up, and started to dress. The only sound, apart from the distant twittering of birds, was the slow, deep breathing of his fellow Gryffindors. He opened his school bag carefully, pulled out parchment and quill, and headed out of the dormitory for the common room. Making straight for his favourite squashy old armchair beside the now extinct fire, Harry settled himself down comfortably and unrolled his parchment while looking around the room. The detritus of crumpled-up bits of parchment, old gobstones, empty ingredient jars and sweet wrappers that usually covered the common room at the end of each day was gone, as were all Hermione's elf hats. Wondering vaguely how many elves had now been set free, whether they wanted to be or not, Harry uncorked his ink bottle, dipped his quill into it, then held it suspended an inch above the smooth, yellowish surface of his parchment, thinking hard. But after a minute or so, he found himself staring into the empty grate, at a complete loss for what to say. He could now appreciate how hard it had been for Ron and Hermione to write him letters over the summer. How was he supposed to tell Sirius everything that had happened over the past week, and pose all the questions he was burning to ask without giving potential letter thieves a lot of information he did not want them to have. He sat quite motionless for a while, gazing into the fireplace, then, finally coming to a decision, he dipped his quill into the ink bottle once more and set it resolutely on the parchment. "Dear Snuffles, hope you're okay. The first week back here's been terrible. I'm really glad it's the weekend. We've got a new Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher, Professor Umbridge. She's nearly as nice as your mum. I'm writing because that thing I wrote to you about last summer happened again last night when I was doing a detention with Umbridge. We're all missing our biggest friend. We hope he'll be back soon. Please write back quickly. Best, Harry." Harry reread the letter several times, trying to see it from the point of view of an outsider. He could not see how they would know what he was talking about, or who he was talking to, just from reading this letter. He did hope Sirius would pick up the hint about Hagrid and tell them when he might be back. Harry did not want to ask directly, in case it drew too much attention to what Hagrid might be up to while he was not at Hogwarts. Considering it was a very short letter, it had taken a long time to write. Sunlight had crept halfway across the room while he had been working on it, and he could now hear distant sounds of movement from the dormitories above. Sealing the parchment carefully, he climbed through the portrait hole and headed off for the owlery.
"I would not go that way if I were you," said nearly headless Nick, drifting disconcertingly through a wall just ahead of Harry as he walked down the passage. "Peeves is planning an amusing joke on the next person to pass the bust of Paracelsus halfway down the corridor."
"Does it involve Paracelsus falling on top of the person's head?" asked Harry.
"Funnily enough, it does," said nearly headless Nick in a bored voice. "Subtlety has never been Peeves's strong point. I'm off to try and find the bloody Baron. He might be able to put a stop to it. See you, Harry."
"Yeah, bye," said Harry, and instead of turning right, he turned left, taking a longer but safer route up to the owlery. His spirits rose as he walked past window after window showing brilliantly blue sky. He had training later. He would be back on the Quidditch pitch at last. Something brushed his ankles. He looked down and saw the caretaker's skeletal grey cat, Mrs. Norris, slinking past him. She turned lamp-like yellow eyes on him for a moment before disappearing behind a statue of Wilfred the Wistful.
"I'm not doing anything wrong," Harry called after her.
She had the unmistakable air of a cat that was off to report to her boss. Yet Harry could not see why. He was perfectly entitled to walk up to the owlery on a Saturday morning. The sun was high in the sky now, and when Harry entered the owlery, the glassless windows dazzled his eyes. Thick, silvery beams of sunlight criss-crossed the circular room in which hundreds of owls nestled on rafters, a little restless in the early morning light, some clearly just returned from hunting. The straw-covered floor crunched a little as he stepped across tiny animal bones, craning his neck for a sight of Hedwig.
"There you are," he said, spotting her somewhere near the very top of the vaulted ceiling. "Get down here. I've got a letter for you."
With a low hoot, she stretched her great white wings and soared down onto his shoulder. "Right. I know this says Snuffles on the outside," he told her, giving her the letter to clasp in her beak, and without knowing exactly why, whispering, "but it's for Sirius, okay?" She blinked her amber eyes once, and he took that to mean that she understood.
"Safe flight, then," said Harry, and he carried her to one of the windows.
With a moment's pressure on his arm, Hedwig took off into the blindingly bright sky. He watched her until she became a tiny black speck and vanished, then switched his gaze to Hagrid's hut, clearly visible from this window, and just as clearly uninhabited, the chimney smokeless, the curtains drawn. The treetops of the Forbidden Forest swayed in a light breeze. Harry watched them, savouring the fresh air on his face, thinking about Quidditch later. Then he saw it. A great reptilian-winged horse, just like the ones pulling the Hogwarts carriages, with leathery black wings spread wide like a pterodactyl's, rose up out of the trees like a grotesque giant bird. It soared in a great circle, then plunged back into the trees. The whole thing had happened so quickly, Harry could hardly believe what he had seen, except that his heart was hammering madly. The owlery door opened behind him. He leapt in shock, and turning quickly, saw Cho Chang holding a letter and a parcel in her hands. "Hi," said Harry automatically. "Oh, hi," she said breathlessly. "I didn't think anyone would be up here this early. I only remembered 5 minutes ago. It's my mum's birthday." She held up the parcel. "Right," said Harry. His brain seemed to have jammed. He wanted to say something funny and interesting, but the memory of that terrible winged horse was fresh in his mind. "Nice day," he said, gesturing to the windows. His inside seemed to shrivel with embarrassment. The weather. He was talking about the weather. "Yeah," said Cho, looking around for a suitable owl. "Good Quidditch conditions. I haven't been out all week, have you?"
"No," said Harry.
Cho had selected one of the school barn owls. She coaxed it down onto her arm, where it held out an obliging leg so that she could attach the parcel.
"Hey, has Gryffindor got a new keeper yet?" she asked.
"Yeah," said Harry. "It's my friend Ron Weasley. Do you know him?"
"The Tornadoes hater," said Cho, rather coolly. "Is he any good?"
"Yeah," said Harry. "I think so. I didn't see his tryout, though. I was in detention."
Cho looked up, the parcel only half attached to the owl's legs. "That Umbridge woman's foul," she said in a low voice. "Putting you in detention just because you told the truth about how he died. Everyone heard about it. It was all over the school. You were really brave standing up to her like that." Harry's insides reinflated so rapidly he felt as though he might actually float a few inches off the dropping-strewn floor. Who cared about a stupid flying horse? Cho thought he had been really brave. For a moment he considered, accidentally on purpose, showing her his cut hand as he helped her tie her parcel onto her owl. But the very instant this thrilling thought occurred, the owlery door opened again. Filch, the caretaker, came wheezing into the room. There were purple patches on his sunken, veined cheeks. His jowls were a-quiver, and his thin grey hair dishevelled. He had obviously run here. Mrs. Norris came trotting at his heels, gazing up at the owls overhead and mewing hungrily. There was a restless shifting of wings from above, and a large brown owl snapped his beak in a menacing fashion.
"Aha!"
said Filch, taking a flat-footed step towards Harry, his pouchy cheeks trembling with anger.
"I've had a tip-off that you were intending to place a massive order for dung bombs."
Harry folded his arms and stared at the caretaker.
"Who told you I was ordering dung bombs?"
Cho was looking from Harry to Filch, also frowning. The barn owl, on her arm, tired of standing on one leg, gave an admonitory hoot, but she ignored it.
"I have my sources," said Filch, in a self-satisfied hiss. "Now, hand over whatever it is you're sending."
Feeling immensely thankful that he had not dawdled in posting off the letter, Harry said, "I can't. It's gone."
"Gone?"
said Filch, his face contorting with rage. "Gone," said Harry calmly. Filch opened his mouth furiously, mouthed for a few seconds, then raked Harry's robes with his eyes.
"How do I know you haven't got it in your pocket?"
"Because I saw him send it," said Cho angrily.
Filch rounded on her.
"You saw him?"
"That's right, I saw him," she said fiercely.
There was a moment's pause, in which Filch glared at Cho, and Cho glared right back. Then the caretaker turned and shuffled back towards the door. He stopped with his hand on the handle and looked back at Harry.
"If I get so much as a whiff of a dung bomb..."
He stumped off down the stairs. Mrs. Norris cast a last longing look at the owls and followed him. Harry and Cho looked at each other. "Thanks," Harry said. "No problem," said Cho, finally fixing the parcel to the barn owl's other leg, her face slightly pink. "You weren't ordering dung bombs, were you?"
"No,"
said Harry.
"I wonder why he thought you were, then," she said as she carried the owl to the window.
Harry shrugged. He was quite as mystified by that as she was, though oddly it was not bothering him very much at the moment. They left the owlery together. At the entrance of a corridor that led towards the west wing of the castle, Cho said, "I'm going this way.
Well, I'll see you around, Harry."
"Yeah, see you." She smiled at him and departed. Harry walked on, feeling quietly elated. He had managed to have an entire conversation with her and not embarrassed himself once.
"You were really brave standing up to her like that."
Cho had called him brave. She did not hate him for being alive. Of course, she had preferred Cedric, he knew that. Though if he'd only asked her to the ball before Cedric had, things might have turned out differently. She had seemed sincerely sorry that she'd had to refuse when Harry asked her. "Morning," Harry said brightly to Ron and Hermione as he joined them at the Gryffindor table in the Great Hall.
"What are you looking so pleased about?" said Ron, eyeing Harry in surprise.
Quidditch later," said Harry happily, pulling a large platter of bacon and eggs towards him.
"Oh, yeah," said Ron.
He put down the piece of toast he was eating and took a large swig of pumpkin juice. Then he said,
"Listen, you don't fancy going out a bit earlier with me, do you? Just to, give me a bit of practice before training, so I can, you know, get my eye in a bit."
"Yeah, okay," said Harry.
"Look, I don't think you should," said Hermione seriously. "You're both really behind on homework, as it..."
But she broke off. The Morning Post was arriving, and as usual, the Daily Prophet was soaring towards her in the beak of a screech owl, which landed perilously close to the sugar bowl and held out a leg. Hermione pushed the knut into its leather pouch, took the newspaper, and scanned the front page critically as the owl took off.
"Anything interesting?" said Ron.
Harry grinned, knowing Ron was keen to keep her off the subject of homework.
"No," she sighed. "Just some guff about the bass player in the Weird Sisters getting married."
Hermione opened the paper and disappeared behind it. Harry devoted himself to another helping of eggs and bacon. Ron was staring up at the high windows, looking slightly preoccupied.
"Wait a moment," said Hermione suddenly. "Oh, no! Sirius!"
"What happened?" said Harry, snatching at the paper so violently it ripped down the middle, with him and Hermione each holding one half.
"The Ministry of Magic has received a tip-off from a reliable source that Sirius Black, notorious mass murderer, blah, 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 is currently hiding in London,"
Hermione read from her half in an anguished whisper.
"Lucius Malfoy, I'll bet anything," said Harry in a low, furious voice. "He did recognise Sirius on the platform."
"What?" said Ron, looking alarmed.
"You didn't say..."
"Shh," said the other two. "Ministry warns wizarding community that Black is very dangerous, killed 13 people, broke out of Azkaban..."
"The usual rubbish,"
Hermione concluded, laying down her half of the paper and looking fearfully at Harry and Ron.
"Well, he just won't be able to leave the house again, that's all," she whispered. "Dumbledore did warn him not to."
Harry looked down glumly at the bit of the Prophet he had torn off. Most of the page was devoted to an advertisement for Madame Malkin's Robes for All Occasions, which was apparently having a sale.
"Hey,"
he said, flattening it down so Hermione and Ron could see it.
"Look at this."
"I've got all the robes I want," said Ron.
"No," said Harry. "Look, this little piece here."
Ron and Hermione bent closer to read it. The item was barely an inch long and placed right at the bottom of a column. It was headlined, "Trespass at Ministry."
Sturgis Podmore, 38, of No. 2 Laburnum Gardens, Clapham, has appeared in front of the Wizengamot, charged with trespass and attempted robbery at the Ministry of Magic on the 31st of August. Podmore was arrested by Ministry of Magic watch wizard Eric Munch, who found him attempting to force his way through a top security door at 1 o'clock in the morning. Podmore, who refused to speak in his own defence, was convicted on both charges and sentenced to 6 months in Azkaban.
"Sturgis Podmore?" said Ron, slowly. "He's that bloke who looks like his head's been thatched, isn't he? He's one of the Order—"
"Ron, shh!" said Hermione, casting a terrified look around them.
"6 months in Azkaban," whispered Harry, shocked. "Just for trying to get through a door?"
"Don't be silly. It wasn't just for trying to get through a door. What on earth was he doing at the Ministry of Magic at 1 o'clock in the morning?"
breathed Hermione.
"Do you reckon he was doing something for the Order?" Ron muttered.
"Wait a moment," said Harry slowly. "Sturgis was supposed to come and see us off, remember?" The other two looked at him.
"Yeah, he was supposed to be part of our guard going to King's Cross, remember? And Moody was all annoyed because he didn't turn up. So he couldn't have been on a job for them, could he?"
"Well, maybe they didn't expect him to get caught," said Hermione.
"It could be a frame-up," Ron exclaimed excitedly. "No, listen," he went on, dropping his voice dramatically at the threatening look on Hermione's face. "The Ministry suspects he's one of Dumbledore's lot, so, I don't know, they lured him to the Ministry, and he wasn't trying to get through a door at all. Maybe they've just made something up to get him."
There was a pause while Harry and Hermione considered this. Harry thought it seemed far-fetched. Hermione, on the other hand, looked rather impressed.
"Do you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised if that were true."
She folded up her half of the newspaper thoughtfully. As Harry laid down his knife and fork, she seemed to come out of a reverie.
"Right. Well, I think we should tackle that essay for Sprout on self-fertilizing shrubs first, and if we're lucky, we'll be able to start McGonagall's Inanimatus Conjurus spell before lunch."
Harry felt a small twinge of guilt at the thought of the pile of homework awaiting him upstairs, but the sky was a clear, exhilarating blue, and he had not been on his firebolt for a week.
"I mean, we can do it tonight," said Ron, as he and Harry walked down the sloping lawns towards the Quidditch pitch, their broomsticks over their shoulders, and with Hermione's dire warnings that they would fail all their OWLs still ringing in their ears.
"And we've got tomorrow. She gets too worked up about work. That's her trouble." There was a pause, and he added, in a slightly more anxious tone, "Do you think she meant it when she said we weren't copying from her?"
"Yeah, I do," said Harry. "Still, this is important too. We've got to practice if we want to stay on the Quidditch team."
"Yeah, that's right," said Ron in a heartened tone. "And we have got plenty of time to do it all." As they approached the Quidditch pitch, Harry glanced over to his right, where the trees of the Forbidden Forest were swaying darkly. Nothing flew out of them. The sky was empty, but for a few distant owls fluttering around the owlery tower. He had enough to worry about. The flying horse wasn't doing him any harm. He pushed it out of his mind. They collected balls from the cupboard in the changing room and set to work, Ron guarding the three tall goalposts, Harry playing chaser and trying to get the quaffle past Ron. Harry thought Ron was pretty good. He blocked three-quarters of the goals Harry attempted to put past him and played better the longer they practiced. After a couple of hours, they returned to the castle for lunch, during which Hermione made it quite clear she thought they were irresponsible, then returned to the Quidditch pitch for the real training session. All their teammates but Angelina were already in the changing room when they entered.
"All right, Ron," said George, winking at him.
"Yeah," said Ron, who had become quieter and quieter all the way down to the pitch.
"Ready to show us all up, Ickle Prefect?" said Fred, emerging tousle-haired from the neck of his Quidditch robes, a slightly malicious grin on his face.
"Shut up," said Ron, stony-faced, pulling on his own team robes for the first time. They fitted him well, considering they had been Oliver Woods, who was rather broader in the shoulder.
"OK, everyone," said Angelina, entering from the captain's office, already changed.
Let's get to it. Alicia and Fred, if you could just bring out the ball crate for us. Oh, and there are a couple of people out there watching, but I want you to just ignore them, all right?
Something in her would-be casual voice made Harry think he might know who the uninvited spectators were, and, sure enough, when they left the changing room for the bright sunlight of the pitch, it was to a storm of catcalls and jeers from the Slytherin Quidditch team and assorted hangers-on who were grouped halfway up the empty stands and whose voices echoed loudly around the stadium.
"What's that Weasley's riding?" Malfoy called in his sneering drawl. "Why would anyone put a flying charm on a mouldy old log like that?"
Crabbe, Goyle and Pansy Parkinson guffawed and shrieked with laughter. Ron mounted his broom and kicked off from the ground, and Harry followed him, watching his ears turn red from behind.
"Ignore them," he said, accelerating to catch up with Ron. "We'll see who's laughing after we play them." "Exactly the attitude I want, Harry," said Angelina approvingly, soaring around them with the quaffle under her arm, and slowing to hover on the spot in front of her airborne team. "OK, everyone, we're going to start with some passes just to warm up. The whole team, please."
"Hey, Johnson, what's with that hairstyle anyway?" shrieked Pansy Parkinson from below. "Why would anyone want to look like they've got worms coming out of their head?"
Angelina swept her long braided hair out of her face and continued calmly.
"Spread out, then, and let's see what we can do."
Harry reversed away from the others to the far side of the pitch. Ron fell back towards the opposite goal. Angelina raised the quaffle with one hand and threw it hard to Fred, who passed to George, who passed to Harry, who passed to Ron, who dropped it. The Slytherins, led by Malfoy, roared and screamed with laughter. Ron, who had pelted towards the ground to catch the quaffle before it landed, pulled out of the dive untidily, so that he slipped sideways on his broom and returned to playing height, blushing. Harry saw Fred and George exchange looks, but uncharacteristically neither of them said anything, for which he was grateful.
"Pass it on, Ron," called Angelina, as though nothing had happened.
Ron threw the quaffle to Alicia, who passed back to Harry, who passed to George.
"Hey, Potter, how's your scar feeling?" called Malfoy. "Sure you don't need a lie down? It must be, what, a whole week since you were in the hospital wing? That's a record for you, isn't it?"
George passed to Angelina. She reverse-passed to Harry, who had not been expecting it, but caught it in the very tips of his fingers and passed it quickly to Ron, who lunged for it and missed by inches.
"Come on now, Ron!" said Angelina crossly, as he dived for the ground again, chasing the quaffle. "Pay attention!"
It would have been hard to say whether Ron's face or the quaffle was a deeper scarlet when he again returned to playing height. Malfoy and the rest of the Slytherin team were howling with laughter. On his third attempt, Ron caught the quaffle. Perhaps out of relief, he passed it on so enthusiastically that it soared straight through Katie's outstretched hands and hit her hard in the face.
"Sorry,"
Ron groaned, zooming forwards to see whether he had done any damage.
"Get back in position, she's fine,"
barked Angelina. "But as you're passing to a teammate, do try not to knock her off her broom, won't you? We've got bludgers for that." Katie's nose was bleeding. Down below, the Slytherins were stamping their feet and jeering. Fred and George converged on Katie.
"Here, take this," Fred told her, handing her something small and purple from out of his pocket. "It'll clear it up in no time."
"All right," called Angelina. "Fred, George, go and get your bats and a bludger. Ron, get up to the goalposts. Harry, release the snitch when I say so. We're going to aim for Ron's goal, obviously." Harry zoomed off after the twins to fetch the snitch.
"Ron's making a right pig's ear of things, isn't he?" muttered George, as the three of them landed at the crate containing the balls and opened it to extract one of the bludgers and the snitch.
"He's just nervous," said Harry. "He was fine when I was practicing with him this morning."
"Yeah, well, I hope he hasn't peaked too soon," said Fred gloomily.
They returned to the air. When Angelina blew her whistle, Harry released the snitch, and Fred and George let fly the bludger. From that moment on,
Harry was barely aware of what the others were doing. It was his job to recapture the tiny, fluttering golden ball that was worth 150 points to the Seeker's team, and doing so required enormous speed and skill. He accelerated, rolling and swerving in and out of the chasers, the warm autumn air whipping his face, and the distant yells of the Slytherins so much meaningless roaring in his ears. But too soon, the whistle brought him to a halt again.
"Stop! Stop! Stop!" screamed Angelina. "Ron, you're not covering your middle post!"
Harry looked round at Ron, who was hovering in front of the left-hand hoop, leaving the other two completely unprotected.
"Oh, sorry."
"You keep shifting around while you're watching the chasers," said Angelina. "Either stay in centre position until you have to move to defend a hoop, or else circle the hoops, but don't drift vaguely off to one side. That's how you let in the last three goals."
"Sorry,"
Ron repeated, his red face shining like a beacon against the bright blue sky.
"And, Katie, can't you do something about that nosebleed?"
"It's just getting worse," said Katie thickly, attempting to stem the flow with her sleeve. Harry glanced round at Fred, who was looking anxious and checking his pockets. He saw Fred pull out something purple, examine it for a second, and then look round at Katie, evidently horror-struck.
"Well, let's try again," said Angelina.
She was ignoring the Slytherins, who had now set up a chant of "Gryffindora losers, Gryffindora losers." But there was a certain rigidity about her seat on the broom, nevertheless. This time they had been flying for barely 3 minutes when Angelina's whistle sounded. Harry, who had just sighted the Snitch circling the opposite goalpost, pulled up, feeling distinctly aggrieved.
"What now?"
he said impatiently to Alicia, who was nearest.
"Katie,"
she said shortly. Harry turned and saw Angelina, Fred and George all flying as fast as they could towards Katie. Harry and Alicia sped towards her too. It was plain that Angelina had stopped training just in time. Katie was now chalk white and covered in blood.
"She needs the hospital wing," said Angelina. "We'll take her," said Fred. "She, might have swallowed a blood blister pod by mistake."
"Well, there's no point continuing with no beaters and a chaser gone," said Angelina glumly, as Fred and George zoomed off towards the castle, supporting Katie between them.
"Come on, let's go and get changed."
The Slytherins continued to chant as they trailed back into the changing rooms.